Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Buffalo Bills. Maybe next year we are only here so we do not get fined. My name is Frank.
That was the correct intro. Well done, Frank. I'm Scott.
I'm Paul.
Way to derail my finally good intro after all these years by just pointing out how good it was.
Sorry, had to.
I was just wondering if it was going to be a Marshawn reference or if it was going to be a Deflategate reference. So
I think up until today it was going to obviously be a Deflategate, and then we all needed a little break from Deflategate, because Lord knows if you watched any news on any channel in any genre, you got Deflategate coverage this last week. And I imagine we are not going to be able to escape this podcast without having a discussion about balls and their appropriate size.
Should this be one of those where we do our podcast without it, and then for people who want more Deflategate coverage, they can tune into the last 10 minutes?
No, because I think that even all Bills coverage has been about Deflategate. Nothing has happened. Largely, we didn't, re-sign Jerry Hughes or anything. So it's been like, here's all the assistance we sort of knew we were getting. And by the way, the Patriots are cheating again. And so I think we will talk about that, but let's not talk about that first.
Okay.
Let's talk about how has your week been, Paul?
It's been great. A little bit busy with the office, but I'm happy to. The only thing I dread about the week is I know at the end of it, a team that I hate is going to win a big football game. So that's the only downside of my week.
All right, you're in a tight spot, Scott. How are you doing?
I've been a little busy around the old orifice, as they say. Ha ha ha! Don't you enjoy that? That'll chestnut.
That was a good one.
Yeah.
Thanks for polishing that off for us.
But other than that, we've been doing good. It's been nice to not have the pressure of talking about the Bills, and worrying about it's not a pressure to talk about the Bills, but it's pressure thinking about them. Like, what are we gonna do? The franchise is going nowhere. Like, where is this going? Obviously with the hiring of Rex, it was a little more of a moment of levity. But even then, as everyone who listened to the podcast last week, which is 99.99% of not the world, most of the world did not listen to the podcast last week. But I was, as people remember, I was not particularly pleased with it. So that it's nice to step away from the Bills for a little while and have some.
Although I will say, in terms of the actual overall population of the world from the beginning of time until now, roughly the same percentage are listening to this podcast as will watch the Super Bowl on Sunday.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's probably not a statistically significant, by the time you calculate all people in the world, we're probably just as large as this American life, I would say, basically.
Right,
you know.
Like 500 million and, whatever we have.
Right, but by the time you're dividing it into 7-8 billion, it's...
Yep.
It's practically nothing.
It's all Sabres playoff chances is what it is, my friends. So let's go through the list of coaches. Two of them had their press conference today too, Thurman and Roman. They keep saying Thurman, and I keep wanting to think it's Thurman Thomas, but it's Dennis Thurman.
Dennis Thurman Thomas.
Defensive coordinator. Greg Roman, offensive coordinator. So you're going to see the 49ers offense. And
Greg Roman Polanski. Sorry.
Yes,
I'm done
Roman.
Now.
All right, Danny Wright Crossman. Chris Palmer, David Lee Roth, quarterbacks coach, Anthony Lynn Davis, no, Anthony Lynn, assistant heads coach, assistant head coach running backs. That's a weird one. I don't really understand why he's the assistant head coach, but whatever. I don't know. Do you guys know? Is that a normal thing?
Yeah, Doug Marone's assistant offensive line coach / assistant head coach. And so I think it's kind of a nod out to people you're probably better than this position based on your criteria, but this is all the only spot we have for you. I think Wonstadt might have the same title.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's we want you on the staff. We don't have a job for you. Normally you would not be doing this job, but because we like you so much, we'll give you this job and a title that earns you a higher salary.
Tony Sperano, junior tight end. Sanjay Lal, wide receivers, Aaron Kramer, offensive line. We're going to be talking about a lot about him because that's going to be a big unit to fix. Kurt Anderson, assistant offensive line. If at any point you want to jump in and say what you think this person sounds like they would actually be doing, please.
Aaron Cromer versus Cromer.
Cromer versus Cromer, very good.
Thank you. I was going to say, can we get like individual offensive line coaches?
Because yeah. I feel like I've been
a guard coach.
What do you think of the Chantrell Henderson coach this year? How's he done?
And the NBA, they have 10 assistant coaches and a head coach for a 12-man team.
Right.
So I feel like there's no salary cap for the coaching staff. So I am strongly in favor of hiring, like, you know, I don't care like how bad your offensive line coach is. If he only has one guy to worry about, I think he'll be able to help him out and like break down the film and, you know, really like sit with the playbook with him and like go through some stuff and honestly like have some accountability, because it's like, hey, Chantrell Henderson doesn't get any better this year. Who do we have to blame?
See, I should get my wife in on this podcast because she can speak to you about individual education plans or IEPs, which is like all the rage now for kids who like have like learning disabilities and or like just need extra help. And you're right, like if you had one coach dealing with one if we had 53 coaches, or I don't know, maybe let's be like 30 coaches, well, we have
right, because Garrison Sanborn does need a coach.
Right, he's good. But like if we had like 40 coaches for everybody else, and you had one, and like you could even devote three of them to quarterback, be like, you're the quarterback's feet coach, you're the quarterback arm coach, you're the quarterback's strength and conditioning coach. The Pegulas have the money for that kind of staff, and I think that, you know, you could probably get some of these guys relatively cheaply. By the time you're an assistant coach, you're not making, you know, you're making 50s and 60s of thousands of dollars, not even, maybe hundreds in the NFL, but I know in hockey you don't make like all that much money as like a third or fourth assistant coach.
Yeah, in the low hundreds, I would think, and especially for kind of like, and you know, you could still break it down by like, you know, this is the right guard position coach. And it's not like he's coaching right guards because he has some specific, you know, like he's right. Left-handed, so he knows right guards a little better or something. It's just, his only job is to work with, you know, whoever we get to play right guard instead of the corpse of Eric Pierce and whoever the backup is, and then that's you know, again, like you're saying, like to a certain extent, and let's be honest, a lot of the guys in the NFL, not the smartest guys in the shed. That's a mixed metaphor right there.
But, so you have one guy.
By the way, I think
Go ahead.
I was going to say the actual corpse of Eric Pierce may have actually had fewer offside penalties or false start penalties.
Right.
But you wouldn't be twitching too much before the snap. So, you know, just one thing to keep in mind there.
We actually gave the Patriots the idea for that four-man offensive line with the fifth guy as the eligible receiver when they were playing us and they saw, well, they're basically only starting four offensive linemen and Eric Pierce, who doesn't count. So that's clearly where they got the idea.
I think that so you have like an offensive coordinator who is in charge of all the offensive coaches, including the offensive line coach, who would then be in charge of like three more offensive line assistants.
He's the middle manager, yeah.
Right, so you'd have the tackles coach and the maybe two, right? You'd have tackles coach and then guard and center coach. I think you could probably roll all three of those guys under one guy.
Yeah.
But if everybody's like doing two or three guys, like that, you know, I like how that came out. That was good.
If you do well, what are your chances of promotion? Like, congratulations, Craig Urbick, coach. You're now the Jason Peters coach.
That's true, actually. That's a good point. Like, and then I think that creates a lot of, you know, competitiveness in the coaching staff, and I think there's a fair degree of competitiveness in the coaching staffs anyway, but I feel like that, you know, a little competition never hurt anybody. You know, raise those standards. You know, yeah. I think...
Whose tackle is better?
Exactly. Like, and then if like it'll turn into Madden, where it's like you can take like the seventh round pick tackle, and like you can help scout out his coaching, you know, his hand placement, and you know his footwork, and slowly over time, his numbers start getting better, and then you're promoted to take over the starting right tackle or the starting left tackle, and then you know 70 years down the line, you take over the entire offensive line, and then you die.
Carl Dunbar, defensive line coach.
I hear something in the background, but it's gone.
Okay.
Yeah, that was weird. It sounded like Susan, but I don't think it was.
It could be the TV that is on in the background where my wife wants to come home and watch television, and I don't blame her.
Absolutely.
So you may be getting a little of background revenge on
ABC. No, it's better now.
Okay, this podcast is brought to you by Revenge on ABC. No, it's not. Jeff Weeks, assistant defensive line coach, Bobby April III, linebackers coach, and probably also special teams coach, even though Eric Smith is the special teams assistant. Danton Lynn, defensive assistant, Tim McDonald, defensive backs, Donnie Henderson, defensive backs. So there you might be getting multiple, you know, people per player. Jason Rebrovich, outside linebackers coach, Mike Hamlin, special teams quality coach.
Mike the Hammer Hamlin.
Right. Jason Osvart, strength and conditioning assistant. And they want Nate Hackett back. So that is apparently a tweet from Jason Lockenfora, right. The Red Sox fan who pretends to be an O's fan. Sorry, there's a whole baseball thing with him in D.C. where he's a real dick about D.C. baseball, and then he's like a Red Sox fan, except when the Orioles are good, and it's just like, blow me, Lockenfora, stick to football. But hey, the Bills apparently want Nate Hackett back in like some sort of offensive capacity thing. Buffalo Rumblings wrote an article about whether there's too many cooks, and I think we've come down strongly on the side of no. Like, we kind of want as many of these people being coached up as possible.
If you can stand the heat, get your ass in the kitchen. Please, join
precisely.
Us in the kitchen. Yeah.
Yes, the kitchen is where we eat and drink. We kind of just stand around the kitchen island. And
absolutely. I think that's, you know, again, like, I feel like that's a lot of families, actually. And, Frank, I'll leave it to make you to make the too many cooks or too many chefs reference.
Too many cooks.
Thank you.
Too many cooks. Right.
But I think I am in, I do kind of, you know, as much as I was kind of joking about the individual offensive line coaches, like, I'm also really not. Like, I think that would be a perfectly legitimate idea because they're all separate jobs. I think I do worry a little bit about when you start getting too many guys in terms of who is the play caller, who is designing the plays, what is the sophistication, what is the goal of the offense, what are we trying to do well. Like, as long as everyone's working from the same page, that's fine. But when you start having, like, assistant, again, we already have one, like, assistant head coaches on the offensive side, like, are they putting input into the offense? Like, how is that working? And at some point, it becomes a little more, unfortunately, like, when you get into the game plans, you really kind of have to have one guy holding the pen, I think, to a certain extent, like, taking input from other people. But someone, unfortunately, has to be the decider, if you want to use that kind of term, so.
Or decision maker, I guess, would be the term. But yeah, I would, you know, I'd agree with Scott. Maybe not to the extent of a personal coach, but like a guards coach, a tackles coach, etc. I wouldn't have an issue with that. And we are seeing that more and more because, you know, back even when we were younger, I'd love to look at the Bills' like 1988 coaching staff, and there would be maybe what 10 people total. Now coaching staffs have probably grown by 1.5 times or more. You know, 15 plus. And I think it's going to continue to trend in that direction. The more, you know, these coaches realize, the more you get to spend time with a player, the more that player, those sets of players are going to improve. So, you know, I think it's not a bad idea at all to go in that direction in the future. I think the question, you know, the big thing you have to worry about, conflicting messages and communication. Make sure the commander gives the directions to his field generals, and then that they give the directions as appropriate to the guys on the field. So I think that's the key, is proper communication, proper lines of order, and I think otherwise I don't mind this many coaches.
I think the one other thing I would want to say, though, is that it is also – I forgot it.
I think the one thing I want to say is like, you can tell by your cadence, like, yeah, he's trying to remember it right now.
Really hard.
That's what's going on at this point.
You forget the one thing that you had.
Exactly.
One thing to remember.
There's one thing you must remember.
I can either do the transition or I can say what I thought. I chose to do the transition.
Actually, you kind of did neither and just sort of stalled out in the middle of the road. That's fine. You know what it was my big sigh, my big, like, yeah, because I think that, you know, there's a certain amount of wheel spinning that's just involved with talking about coaches is because the truth is we don't know whether it's a good idea to have 1,000 coaches or not.
None of us are experts enough on these coaches to be able to.
And even if we were experts, my guess is, as most expert opinions are, is they would be something along the lines of, well, it depends on the coaches you have and whether they're that type of staff. I guess we could say that today that the defensive coordinator Thurman was sort of saying that, you know, it should be it's a very player-friendly defensive system that they plan to put in. He used the word, what did he say? They want to set the pace, they want to dictate. He used the word dictate 17 times or so in about the span of 2.5 sentences.
Makes him a dictator.
Yes, and he wants to dictate the pace. That's the kind of defense that they're going to have. But largely, it's going to be a little different, but there's going to be a lot of overlap because they're going to play to the strengths of the personnel, which is a nice sounding thing, because I think when you have a really good unit, it's a stupid thing to come in and sort of revamp the whole deal. So that was good. And Greg Roman said lots of things like he's confident that they can do well and that they're going to do well with a guy even like EJ Manuel. And if they had wanted to, the 49ers could have led the league in rushing, and it's not like that's not the issue. Like, the issue was they wanted to do some other things, and so it's going to be ground and pound, and like basically the answer is don't even worry about it. Do you guys worry about it? I mean, we could talk a little bit about the players in that we have in conjunction with coaches, or is that sort of a fruitless discussion since we don't really know many of the key players we have until at least for a month, right?
Yeah, I think this is a good discussion for the post-draft, post-free agency. Like, you know, a lot of people are expressing concern about the power running game that Greg Roman influenced to move to that side of the ball, not to get away from Thurman, which I'll get back in a second. But, you know, if Spiller's gone and, you know, Brown or Dixon is shown the door, even God forbid, Freddie, and they bring in more of a power back, then it makes total sense. And I think the same's going to go with the other side, too. Bill Parcells was always a big proponent that, you know, everyone likes to say, if you start making exceptions to the types of players you want on a team, you're going to find yourself with a team full of exceptions, and you're not going to get them under the same, under the same set of rules. So just something to keep in mind there.
Yeah, I mean, I think with me in general about the coaches is that I feel like it's a very rare kind of coach, and it's not just coaches, it's managers, it's people who get into middle management positions in highly kind of competitive fields. You know, they, you know, especially if you're not really like brilliant, if you're not really flexible and understand where your limitations are and where your strengths are, and understand that there are people who might do things better than you, it's very hard not to put jigsaw pieces in a puzzle back into the same spots that you had them before. And it's very rare to see someone who can really say, like, this piece of the puzzle doesn't fit here, but it's still a perfectly good piece of the puzzle. It fits in a puzzle somewhere. I just have to figure out what that puzzle is and where all these other pieces fit. And I think we're going to find out this year exactly, you know, with this new coaching staff, how good at that they are. Because I think to a certain extent with the last couple coaching staffs, I think there have been some moves to, well, you know, we really need a big, tall, wide receiver, so let's go get a big, tall, wide receiver. And it doesn't matter if it's Mike Williams who's going to wash out in, you know, 3 or 4 weeks. You know, that's something that we need for my offense to run. And I think even though consciously you might say, well, I'm flexible, I want to do with what the players dictate, I want to play to their strengths because that's the best thing, I think there's a natural instinct, especially if you've succeeded and moved your career forward from high school to college to the pros, that you know what's best and what works and what your strong points are, and that makes you want to put people, even subconsciously, into positions that maybe they're not best equipped to succeed in. So that I think does play into decisions about how do we retain our running backs? What do we do with Jerry Hughes? What do we do with Manny Lawson? What do we do with Kiko Alonso, Nigel Bradham, and Preston Brown? Like, those are all very key personnel decisions that I feel like as of going into this season, we had a perfectly good system in place. Mm-hmm. So if anything less, you know, and if they want to change it, that's fine. But as Breck said, like, I expect us to be number one. I certainly expect them to be no worse than number four. That's for damn sure. If they're anything close to number four, and they've made a bunch of personnel changes, then you know where the check, you know where the, you know, the buck stops. So.
Mm-hmm. The buck stops with Rex.
Because he ate it.
Yes. Sorry, the beer kind of kicked in right then, just as you finished your point, and
now our host, our lead host, is hammered.
It's the off season, folks. Drink it in.
This is tough. I'm sorry. All right, I'm gonna power through. I'm here so I don't get fined. That's my answer. Okay, so we talked about the coaches. I guess it's because I'm struggling to think about things to talk about for kind of the reasons we all, like, Pepper Johnson went to the Jets. Do I care? Not really. You know, it's a little too early to talk about draftees. I saw Todd Gurley and a wide receiver preview. So
Amari Cooper,
which is great, but like, do we need either of those positions? Probably not wide receiver. Maybe running back, depending on like what happens with C.J. Spiller and how confident they are in Fred Jackson. But
let's not discount wide receiver too quickly. I think we were all pleasantly surprised with Chris Hogan on what he did to emerge as the number three guy. But there's still, as much as I think we all like Chris and respect what he did, there's still room to upgrade there. And you look at Goodwin, who is a healthy scratch for two or three games. There's not all that much behind Watkins and Woods, really, and easily as a specialist. So just throwing that out there.
I guess I was just thinking that if you had, with Watkins and Woods and a likely someone stepping up to be a third wide receiver, there's probably better places to put your focus,
especially because as we talked about the power running offense, you're not going to have as many three receiver sets as we've been used to seeing out of the Bills.
Right. Okay. So,
yeah. I think it is a little early to be talking about the draft. I mean, we could all throw some more dirt on Doug if you want. I mean,
I think it's kind of great. I saw Adam Schefter was defending his decision, which I think there's a difference between defending his decision to take $4 million and leave and then also shoveling a little dirt on him for how it all worked out for him. Like, you're right. Like, that might be a completely sane decision if I'm Doug Marrone. And Adam Schefter is writing the article because he has the same agent. But maybe that's one thing. But on the other hand, it's still really going to always be funny that he's now the Jacksonville Jaguars offensive line coach and that he totally went all in on a pair of twos in the pocket and he got hammered.
So the rest of the NFL called his bluff. And now, yeah.
If he had a Texas Hold'em hand, what was his Texas Hold'em hand going into, like, his pushing all the pot, you know, the chips into the pot?
Well, I think the funny thing
is, wasn't pocket twos, but it was the like funny
thing is he is actually a fairly conservative player, as we learned on fourth down this year. Mm. So for him to take this big of a gamble, he probably thought he had a decent hand.
Yes.
A pretty big Gandalf.
Yes, the Gandalf.
You shall not pass. Oh, that was his philosophy on every fourth down. You shall not pass.
It actually hit my head when I was laughing out loud, and then you actually said what was in my head at that moment.
Brilliant. Very good.
We're retiring now. I don't think we can get better than that.
Well, that's the end of the podcast, everyone.
Thanks for listening these 3 years. Sorry, Scott. I think we took your
thunder
there.
No. I don't think it's going to get any better than that from my comment. But what was I saying?
He was taking a gander.
Oh, no. I was taking a gander. Oh, yeah. His cards, given his conservative nature, I would bet that he thought that he wouldn't have done this if he didn't think he had at least, pair of eights.
Maybe eights or nines. And
yeah, exactly. And it's like, you know, but that's the thing. He thought he was at like a two or three man table, but he was actually at like an eight or nine man table.
Yeah.
He was not quite reading the room correctly because there were some sharks out there in the form of, you know, Vic Fangio or a half a dozen other guys who were viable head coaching candidates at the same time. And he completely misread how people viewed his departure from Buffalo as a 9-7 head coach that he had performed. Again, like, I think he probably thought he did the miracle of Doug, St. Doug Marrone, and, you know, turned us into a winning team, and now it was time for him to get his. And, you know, I think people were a little skeptical that the Bills weren't more than a one-year wonder.
He was hitting on 16. He was hitting on 16, and the dealer was showing, like, a 4. And it was just like, come on, dude. You just know. We have a little cheat sheet that we give you, so you don't you like everyone's allowed to have that cheat sheet, so they know not to do that.
Okay. Yeah.
Then in that case, I think it's time to join our
the
national
media. Sorry.
Yes. Well, to join our national media brethren in the coverage of the Super Bowl via the cheating sons of whores that are the New England Patriots, who probably, and I feel like I'm speaking for the podcast here, should be stripped of their NFL franchise, and it should be moved to Toronto.
I think Tom Brady should be drawn and quartered.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
In Boston Commons at dawn on Super Bowl Sunday.
Yeah.
As an example for all the people of New England.
Absolutely.
On how to on what happens to cheaters.
And I think
they never prosper.
Well, he should be drawn and quartered into three, well, like to 29 parts. And they should, like, every part of the NFL should get part of the Brady body. Except for his head, which we will burn and then put at the bottom of the sea.
Like the Hydra, to a certain extent. Yeah, you have to burn those stumps.
Yes.
You could also, the one thing you could also do is you could inflate him to between 12.5 PSI and 13.5 PSI.
Interesting.
And then deflate him to 11.5 PSI and see what he feels, how he feels about that. If he notices a difference in the balls.
In his balls. Yes, not all of him. I think we should just inflate his testicles,
his testicles
to 13 PSI and then back down to 11. Paul, what should we do with Bill Belichick?
Geez, well, we've already done the good stuff to Tom, so,
Maybe we should hire him as defensive coordinator of the Buffalo.
I'm trying to think of what would work best with his downtrodden, smug personality. It would just be amazing. I would almost want them to force him to perform on stage in, say, a production of Burlesque.
Okay.
That, I think, would be the punishment for the rest of his life.
That's good. I'm thinking
that,
like,
is nice.
I'm thinking he has to be Minnie Mouse at Disney World for, like, a year.
That's a good one. I like that too. I was thinking, I think in college at some point I read Inferno, and so you always have to remember, you know, you end up when you go to hell, you end up paying for it in a kind of symmetric, but wrong, you know, symmetric but over exaggerated sense. So
correct.
I would say that because he doesn't, you know, he didn't see anything, he didn't hear anything, he's never known about any of these things. I think he should have his eyes gouged out. I think he should have his, you know, his ears ripped off. You know, he didn't tell anyone to deflate or not deflate the balls. Probably have his tongue torn out. So he has to go around deaf, dumb, and blind, you know, attempting to coach. And I think that would be kind of, you know, obviously he could do it because he could still, you know, type on a keyboard or something. But I still think that would be a little bit more appropriate for Bill. But I also like the, because clearly he hates, you know, being in front of people. So that works too.
Well, we could make him deaf, dumb, and blind in hell, and then force him to be the lead in Tommy, which would be the, you know, the hell production for the next millennia.
Yeah.
You know, although I would kind of want him to not maybe have some sort of weird thing implanted in his brain where he could see himself on stage, like, in his mind's eye, but, like, even though he can't really see, and so he would see and hear all the things happening to him, but he couldn't see and hear them, like, directly. So
yeah, he couldn't stop it. He couldn't change it. He just was aware that it was happening.
Right. Well, we're going to put all of this in a letter to Roger Goodell and suggest it into the, you know, the rules committee. You know,
as long as they're coming up with arbitrary punishments in the NFL front office, I think ours are just as legitimate as anyone else's.
Okay. The smartest thing that I've heard about this entire thing is that whatever you thought of the Patriots going into this is probably what you'll think of the Patriots going out of it. Unfortunately, the person who said that was a really smug New England guy who was sort of like defending them to the hilt, which, I don't know, I'm sort of, I don't think this should be a massive issue now that we're going to get to reality here for a minute. That was all... Right. We'll finish up with some torturing.
Let's come back to the fantasy later.
We'll come back to the fantasy torturing of the Patriots. But for now,
I got one for Josh McDaniels. Don't worry about that.
Oh, good. It better involve Tebow. I didn't want this to be a huge deal. It did, on some level, seem like scuffing a baseball to me, where, like, it's totally, like, you shouldn't do it, but, like, the punishment should be the player who did it is suspended for a little bit or is fined, and that's the end of it. Obviously, the huge deal is that it happened in a championship game, at least in a championship game, and according to some sources before that, within the Ravens game and possibly the Colts game before that, which leads to the speculation that it could have been happening for a long time. You can balance that with the idea that everyone else is sort of doing it, but on the same token, like, if everyone's speeding but they pull you over, it's not really much of a defense.
Right, it's the Cranberries defense. Everyone else is doing it, so why can't we?
Right.
Does anyone remember that album from the early 90s?
I remember the songs, but I don't remember the album.
No, you lost me on that one.
All right, I'm going to Google to make sure that's correct, and you guys continue talking about
it. Was that when the Marquis de Lafayette was their front man?
Yes. Yes, it was.
Okay, I remember that, actually, yeah.
Let me quickly get you to my transition point so that way Scott can pick it up while Paul continues to look up the name of a Cranberries album. What happened was, this didn't go away, right? Like, on Tuesday, it was clear that this was going to be a week-long discussion. By Tuesday, it was like there was, like, Bill Belichick was talking about it, Tom Brady was talking about it, you know, like, completely not to form. And the more I thought about it, the thing that I think bugs people, and it certainly bugs me, is that even though we sort of know there's a certain amount of gamesmanship going on, the entire my ability to accept the fact that the Patriots are a great football team rests on the fact that, like, they've been playing on basically a level playing field with the rest of us, right? That they've just managed to do this thing. That's the point of sport. That on an equal playing field, that, you know, these people are better than these people, and that's what makes it okay that, you know, you that's what makes you accept what's going on, why I tune in at all. Because why would I want to tune into an unlevel playing field? If I did, I would still watch wrestling, right? I would watch what is a scripted thing. So I think what the folks in Boston particularly and the people who sort of want to, like, focus on the game of the Super Bowl a bit more might be missing is this sort of cuts to the core of the trust of the sport, which is, like, by the way, like, the fifth or sixth thing just this year that has cut to the trust of the sport in the NFL. And so the problem isn't so much that we aren't going to turn into the Super Bowl and we don't like watching football, or that we think that, like, you know, we're naive enough to think that teams aren't trying to get an advantage. I think the problem is that the way this has been dealt with is that it doesn't take serious the fact that there's a compact between the fan watching and the sport being played, that there is something legitimate happening. And that, so I think that's actually what the real problem is, that there's some dislegitimacy, at least to their play in this game. I'm going to look back on the Patriots. I'm always going to think they were kind of jerks, but they were a really good football team. And even if they did cheat, I'm going to think about the way that I do Barry Bonds. It's like, Barry Bonds was a great baseball hitter. He's never going to not be a great baseball hitter to me, even though he cheated and used steroids. He's a cheater, but you know what? He's still light years better than most people who ever hit a baseball, and I'm never going to let go of that. Scott, I feel like you're the person most likely to disagree with me, so I'm going to go to you first.
No, I mean, I think it's
and I could hear Scott feverishly writing notes, so I know.
scribble.
I wish I was, because you raised a lot of points, but I don't care that much, so I'm not going to do that. But so no, I mean, and it's funny because I have been dealing with this at work, because there's at least two Pats fans within about 25 feet of me. They're both fairly reasonable as fat Pats fans go, which means that they're assholes, but they're not huge assholes. So
right.
And then there's a friend of mine who I work right next to, and she is rooting for the Patriots because she hates the Seahawks. So they've been kind of talking a lot about this and how it's not going to matter.
Which, by the way, if for a rationale for rooting for the Patriots on Sunday, I think that's the correct one. If you have to have one.
You know. I want to get to the root of why you dislike the Hawks, but don't let me forget that, because I would like all to right. know exactly why you dislike them so much. But go ahead,
yeah,
Scott.
We'll come back to that. But anyway, yeah, I mean, no, Frank, you hit on like the basically like a lot of Malcolm Gladwell's points about how I think it was Gladwell. I forget who it was. But basically, the point is that, you know, yeah, like, it's not the point that PEDs are or are not illegal in sports. We made the rules of the sport so that you can't use PEDs. And whether or not it's bad for you or not, everyone is supposed to be playing by those rules. And if you don't, it's like saying that Tom Brady gets to, you know, they only need 5 yards for a first down or 8 yards for a first down. Like, that's not the point of the game. It's not fair. So I agree, and I agree with what you said. Like, the Pats were a great fucking team the last 15 years, and that's what the guy at the office said, the one who I kind of agree with on this. It's like, they didn't need to do this. They beat the Colts handily the last 3 times they played them, and I don't think the balls were deflated for all of those because they're playing indoors, and it's a different thing. I think that was kind of the exigent circumstances of, you know, it's a championship game, you know, it's cold, we needed to do this, yada, yada, yada. So I think that's probably why they maybe it happened in this case. I think the one thing, though, is that the thing that bothers me the most is that, and to me it's a little worse than scuffing a ball or something like that, is that this was not, it was 11 balls. It was 11 balls. They were 11 out of the 12. They were all deflated. This was not, you know, just kind of one guy acting on his own, you know, with no kind of well, you know, it might be a little illegal, but it's not, like, super illegal. What's the worst that can happen? This was a deliberate effort to alter, like, the balls that they were playing with. And so it's as much the intent as it is the impact. And it's again, like, I understand, like, I agree, it would not have mattered in that game. You know, the Patriots could have been playing with 10 players the whole time, and they could have freaking beat them. And the thing that, and Frank, you kind of touched on it, like, in terms of the cheaters and stuff, you know, when I think about Belichick and Brady, you know, again, like, they didn't need to do any of this, but the insane kind of will to win that gets you to the peak of success is also the thing that makes you kind of consistently look for advantages that are on the borderline or that are over the line. And honestly, like, it's, to me, I draw a line from Spygate, and I know that it got blown out of our proportion and people are bringing it up a lot now, but I draw the line from Spygate to all this bullshit formation stuff that they're doing. I understand it's legitimate within the rules of the game to bring in 5 guys as your offensive line. Only one of them's a tight end, and he's actually an eligible receiver while Shane Vereen is out there standing, you know, where the wide receivers are. I understand that is within the rules of the game, but at the same point, no one freaking tunes in to see that shit. They tune in to see inventive plays within the kind of conventional wisdom of an offense. Like, if we all wanted to watch that stuff, we could watch chess. But we're watching it because we want to be entertained.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Because we want to be entertained. We want to understand that everyone's kind of playing with the same basic assumptions of how to run an offense. And sure, you know, you can do some things with the Wildcat, and people will figure it out after a while. But pulling this kind of shit where you just break it on people in the playoffs in an attempt to kind of, and again, it's like, did you not trust your team that they were good enough to beat them? Because if so, then, you know, I don't know. It's just, I get frustrated because, yeah, like, I know they were going to probably beat the Colts anyway, and I fucking hate them. But at the same time, like, you don't need to do this. Like, just why? I don't, it does bother me, so.
Yeah, I mean, I think as I guess I'm not jumping in. There was certainly a silence enough there for me to say something. You know, I hate it because it almost makes me a Patriots apologist on the front end. Then I'm going to end up agreeing with Scott and Frank essentially too. But you know, there's, to go back to the Cranberries thought, everybody else is doing it, so why can't we? Which was a Cranberries album featuring such hits as I've Lost the Page. Such hits as Dreams in Linger, for example. Now I can close that page. But onto the football issue, you know, this is something that I'm sure is relatively widespread. To go to the specific game, we note that Indianapolis scored 7 points, and the Patriots largely beat them with the 800 yards rushing from Blount. You know, so, which he could have done carrying a beach ball, I think, is one of the Patriots secondary players said. The facts of the matter are that game was going to be won by the Patriots. And again, the people complaining about the eligible receiver thing, all it requires in the offseason is a simple rule change by the NFL, and you know, or adjustment to make sure the Patriots aren't taking advantage of the rule, and then that issue is taken care of. But I have no issue with the Patriots doing it within the confines of the rule book. What I do have the issue with, again, and I think it's the same thing that Scott has the issue with, is it's just this culture that's created of by the Patriots of we're going to just continually cross this line, and we're going to do it in ways that are so obvious that other teams are calling us out on it. Like if every team was deflating the balls as much as the Patriots, you know, the Colts wouldn't have thought to call them out on it and test the balls and find that 11 of the 12 were ineffective. So that indicates to me that there was some serious abuse of what's a general abuse. Like it goes from, you know, the guy on second base stealing signs to the guy on second base getting a mind-reading device and communicating with the pitcher as to what he is about to throw and the batter with what's coming. You know, I think that's where it really steps over the line that it bothers me from that perspective. And I was listening to a former Bills player who I definitely want to talk about this fascinating interview with him, saying, like, you know, he played when Brady played, knows that Tom Brady is anal, in his words, and said no doubt he was having these balls artificially deflated, and that when this player played, it was actually the home team that would provide the balls. So they almost always had an advantage, the home team did, in this situation. Yeah. Now it's a little more balanced. So just food for thought. But again, the thing that bothers me, it's consistently the Patriots who seem to get caught doing this stuff.
Yeah, it is. I think that there is definitely something. Wow, I just got handed a chocolate chip cookie I didn't know we had in our house. It's dangerous.
That's the best moment ever in life.
Like, there were secret cookies in my house.
Yep. Sometimes I get home and my wife will, on the counter, there'll be a cookie she's picked up from work that day, and I think, this is why I got married. Right here. Because you get surprise cookies.
All right. Yep. Anyway, do you want to talk about Marshawn Lynch, Frank, or do you want to just...
Well, we promised we would hit the Patriots one more time, so...
Oh, right. Yeah, we're going to do our fantasy Patriots punishments.
So I feel like the Patriots should have to be the focus of Fallout 4, where, like, the entire thing happens in Gillette Stadium after the rest of the world destroys Gillette Stadium via nuclear blast. I think that's a fair punishment.
That's a good one. I like that. I was going to say, like, my kind of extraneous punishment is, you know, so, again, like, you know, I think Paul's right. I think Brady definitely knew what was going on. But I would say that this is something that probably, you know, Belichick may not have known. This could have been a very much like, you know, Brady kind of did it on his own, and then mm-hmm. some of the equipment guys were talking amongst themselves, and maybe they brought it up to, like, the quarterback coach, I think McDaniels probably knows, because I think he's just a sneaky son of a bitch. I don't like the cut of his jib. So I say McDaniels has to go, and when the NFL you know, is trying to get a franchise set up in London, I think he has to go door-to-door and explain to people in England about how American football works and why they should root for people. I think you should go out to pubs on, like, you know, Saturday evenings, you know, when everyone's watching Manchester United or whatever, in, like, a big NFL sweater or something, and explain to people how the NFL game is superior and how they should be watching that in their spare time. I think that would be...
And you should have to do it, like, in a France rugby or soccer kit.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's Germany is the traditional football rival of England. So I would say yes. If he was wearing a Team Deutschland uniform, that would be even better.
And is before I give my answer, speaking of European sports, how are we with the 9:30 a.m. Game? That's going to be something, huh?
Oh, God.
That is something kind of interesting.
Watching football, drinking coffee. I mean, I used to drink coffee when we were at the bar. Because I used to sleep until like 11 o'clock from drinking the night before, and then I would have coffee there. But I mean, I can actually just sit on the couch drinking coffee and eating eggs. That's crazy.
I'll tell you what, as a kid, I would have loved it. And I had a friend who grew up in Hawaii who said he loved watching the NFL because it was on during breakfast. And as an older man, I am totally okay with it.
Yep,
I think as like a 20-something, I probably would have been kind of pissed off and then organized some sort of like kegs and eggs deal to watch football. But right now, it's like the best thing is going to be like The game's going to be over. It happened to me in San Francisco. I went and saw, I was in San Francisco. I watched the Bears destroy the Bills on TV. It started at 10 in the morning. I was at 12:30. The game was over, and I had the rest of my day in glorious San Francisco to, like, you know, eat Ghirardelli ice cream and enjoy myself, and I was so happy.
Wow,
so,
you're going way back to 2006 there with that.
You are. Look at this mother effer.
Who is this guy?
Like, pinning the year based on that short description.
I remember you said the Bills-Bears game, and I remember that 06 game so well because, what was her name? Remember Verity at the bar?
Yeah.
Won the 2006 season, only season she was there, and I remember
She was a one-year wonder MVP of the team. Like, she was stepped in through 40 touchdowns and then left.
Yep.
She was great.
Yeah, she was, and I remember being at that. We were doing shots by the middle of the third quarter.
Yeah, it was
close. That is my recollection of that game. And well, those are the days where you could smoke in the bars, and she was just, like, chain-smoking her way through with that game. So that was good times. But times now I would rather sit at home and eat breakfast and watch football.
Exactly. The nice thing about San Francisco was, like, my entire day was there. I ate lunch. I went to bed, like, the game was, like, 9-10 hours ago, and I felt very, like, whatever. I was already kind of over the game. And I feel like that's how the London game will go. And if you win, then even better. It's, like, noon, your football team's won, and your wife is happy because the whole afternoon is not watching football.
Yep. And to answer my Patriots punishment, I don't want to go into detail. Just needless to say, meth head face eaters and the Patriots.
Very nice.
That's all.
Very nice. We could do, Paul, do you have this day in Bills history?
Oh, how can we not do this day in Bills history?
I was going to say, like, I hoped you knew what today in Bills history was.
It is the day Scott Appleton became a Bills fan, is it not?
It is, in fact, the day that Scott Appleton became a Bills fan.
Yeah, I suppose it is, isn't it?
It was 20 years ago today, or 22 years
24.
Ago? 24.
That's how old we are.
It was 24 years ago today that the Bills and the Giants played.
A young Whitney.
Martin Levy's Lonely Hearts Football Team.
Indeed. By the way, rest in peace, Whitney Houston. How's that for a fucking reality check?
Yeah.
Anyway, well, let's not steal the thunder. We have a This Day in Bills History guy, so please, sir.
Yeah, it was, by the way, halftime show is, that'll be my trivia question. But yeah, we're not going to go into too much detail on the game summary because, you know, we all know it was the Bills-Giants Super Bowl, the first Super Bowl. And it was a back and forth game. The Giants had that; they were very inventive that day. They had what was the first time you'd ever see on the field really a 2-5 front.
As my father said, they never came out and actually played football. My dad, to this day, bringing up Super Bowl 25, he says they are a bunch of basically, and then he uses bad words and says, like, you know, why didn't they just come out and play the effing game?
Yeah, and it was terrible. I think a lot of people say, oh, the Bills win that game 9 out of 10 times. I think it might be closer to 7 out of 10 times. I think people underrate a 13-3 Giants team that beat every team it played that year. The only team they lost were the Eagles, 49ers, and Bills, and they ended up beating them. They had a defense that allowed fewer points than anyone in the NFL. They were one of the only three teams with 13-3 or better records. The Giants were a great team. Let's not forget that. But the Bills, I think, were probably a superior
team. They were the better team. Absolutely.
Yeah, it would be a more of a debate if the Giants even started their starting quarterback.
Yep.
Right. Jeff Ostetler.
Yeah.
He fumbled in the end zone.
Actually, he didn't fumble in the end zone. That was the key there. He held on to the ball and got safety.
He did fumble in the end zone.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it was an incredible game. Bill Belichick, you know, we were talking about him in depth earlier. I mean, this was where he made a name for himself was this game, saying, you know, Jim Kelly was not as good as reading defense as other quarterbacks, just a great athlete and a great player. So he would switch coverages from one drive to the next. As I was mentioning earlier, he played with two down linemen and five linebackers most of the game. You look at the Bills' last drive of that game, the only one where they convert a third down, but he had the Bills only completed two passes that entire drive. They gained their yardage on Kelly scrambles and Thurman Thomas runs because the coverage was just giving them absolutely nothing, and that's what led to them only being able to get to the 30-yard line with 8 seconds left and killing the game for the team and making it too long a field goal for Norwood, who never in his career would make one that long on grass. So it was not a fluke that he missed that kick.
Yeah, it was a tough kick, and yeah. There was wind, and I don't know if you know, but like the Super Bowl was on the line, so there was
a little bit of pressure on that. So, you know, I look back on that game, and I think, you know, it's the one who really feels a lost opportunity. You can make an argument that the Bills had a decent chance to win the fourth one again, the second game against Dallas, their fourth one overall. Mm-hmm. They clearly had the best chance to win this game. They had a 12-3 lead. Defense couldn't get off the field when it needed to. Offense was very stubborn. It's commitment to the pass, even though Thomas was averaging between 9 and 10 yards a carry.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was this day, January 27th, 1991. My two-sided trivia question. One, which band about to play on a reunion tour with other acts had the halftime show? And the question on the player, which Giants starter was a Bills coach last season?
Okay, so the easy one is Pepper Johnson because he was the Giants coach. And I feel like bad because I've just sort of given one away since I knew that one. But the band, 1992. 91. I'm not sure. I'm gonna let Scott do some guessing.
Okay, so Frank threw out Pepper Johnson, and Paul didn't disagree right away. So that makes me think that even though there was a part of me that definitely thought it was Pepper Johnson, despite the fact that I'm terrible at this game, and or awesome at this game, depending on
how
you
I think you'd never lost. I don't think
you'd still 100%.
Yeah.
So there's a strong, very strong part of me that thinks that Pepper Johnson is the correct answer. However, just on the off chance that it's not, and I think this is still my call, I am going to have to go with Japanese Emperor Taisho, who, as everyone knows, is the 123rd Emperor of Japan, who reigned until his death in 1926. Because I recall that I forget who was doing the game exactly. I don't know if it was Al Michaels or if it's John Madden, but I remember him talking about, you know, Taisho, you know, blows up, you know, I forget whoever was playing for the offensive line of the Bills at the time, but Taisho blows up, you know, whoever, and he's on to Kelly, you know, for the sack. So I think that was what I was thinking for the player. But as for the band, I'm gonna have to think about that one a little more, actually.
He did blow out the House Ballard. I remember that. And you remember how he died, of course, was he overinflated his balls and just exploded in shame.
That's the reason why it's illegal.
In a hari kari sort of moment, you know, committed seppuku.
Right, and you're both, of course, correct, because lining up alongside right inside linebacker Pepper Johnson was left inside linebacker Emperor Taisho. Subbing in for Gary Reasons that day, who would be the normal left inside linebacker for the.
I can't think of who the band is, so it's 1991. They would have to be a semi-established act by then. It wouldn't
right.
be like.
It did go down in history. It voted the second worst halftime show ever, and it came in second only to one, and I would disagree. I think it was the worst ever. It came in second to the Black Eyed Peas Usher Tron show, but I think that one wins only because it's more recent. It was a terrible show, but it's more recent, so I think it got that vote.
That was a terrible show.
But this one featured the band played with Warren Moon, and he was frolicking with Minnie Mouse at various points.
Wow. Yeah, I'm going to have to go ahead and say.
Oh, I've lost my headphones.
Frank has lost his headphones at this momentous moment.
Oh, okay.
I unplugged my headset there. Sorry.
That was an unfortunate.
That was poor. Which makes me believe that it was definitely the Beatles.
The Beatles.
I'm gonna go with the Beatles.
Okay. All right. Well, I thought about the Beatles. The Beatles briefly. Then it did occur to me that I felt that this show did have a slightly more militaristic of point.
It was the thing.
So I was thinking, you know, it's probably something, you know, having to do with the U.S. or our allies. you know, and then I was like, you know what, maybe I'm onto something here. So maybe it was English something. So again, I was thinking, you know, maybe the Beatles is in there as, you know, a band, yeah, which is normally what you would have for your halftime show at the Super Bowl. But I decided on, I'll just cut to the chase, HMS Bridgewater, the 6th rate 20-gun ship of the Royal Navy, which was built in 1740 and wrecked in 1743. You know, again, Christmas Day, funnily enough, of 1742, she was in a fight with the Santa Rita off of Newfoundland, but did not end up making it back to England, and so ended up then going on, you know, almost 200 years later into the, a little more than 200 years later into the Super Bowl halftime show of Super Bowl 25.
So,
well,
which one was it yet? Was it
HMS Bridgewater?
Right, because she was part of the, after the crash with Rita, she was part of Crosby, Stills, Nash, Rita, and Bridgewater.
Yes.
For many years before she was then like the Traveling Wilburys.
yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
and then some of her indie stuff from the last couple of years has been pretty good, but you know, it's a little dark. I'll say it. You know, she's been alive for 300 years. It's, you know, as a corporeal entity, you know, it happens, I guess.
Yep, I guess so.
You know, what's funny, I'm a little disappointed, Scott. Scott normally doesn't miss by this much. He obviously totally forgot that Miss Bridgewater, 2 years prior to the Super Bowl, was replaced in the band by Donnie Wahlberg. So, you know, come on, Scott. You know, I expect you to remember
that. Yeah, I did not see that.
Miss Bridgewater was gone before playing with TLC and Nelly on a summer tour.
Well, I think the double
kids on the block. Yeah,
the double question definitely threw him. Like, it's very taxing to have to come up with two.
Right.
Answers,
so he did great on Emperor Tai's show, but then, I mean, come on, we all remember Bridgewater got knocked out for Donnie. You know,
the HMS Bridgewater, the Royal Navy ship. Yeah, no, that's probably should have thought that one through a little more. But
that's,
I think,
okay,
my perfect record remains intact. So that's the good news.
Yes. It would not be the first time you got one wrong and then also had a perfect record. So, Paul, why don't you give us what you thought the answers were with, you know, with facts.
It wasn't Donnie Wahlberg?
It was the NKOTB, New Kids on the Block, featuring, you know, which does feature Donnie Wahlberg, and it had they are on tour with TLC and Nelly this summer, as I mentioned. So
okay. They are. I should have remembered that because I saw that ad the other day, and I was like, oh my God, I can't.
That's kind of good. That's like two of the worst Super Bowls together in one concert, plus TLC.
Yeah.
Well, plus as much of TLC as is left, because I believe Left Eye is...
Left Eye did not make it.
It's just TC at this point.
Yeah.
Right.
T-Boz and Chili.
And T has the fucking, pardon, has the sickle cell anemia, so like, you know, like, we're all... Anyway, let's just send a little TLC to TLC.
Yeah. I mean, because we're running longer than we expected, shocking, I've got a good story which I mentioned to you guys, which we'll save for another podcast.
Frank appears to be mixing a drink, so I think it's time to wrap it up.
Frank's already checked out.
Can you just confirm the head coach, the coach?
Oh, it was Pepper Johnson.
Yeah, all right, good.
Yeah, okay.
You guys are both right. So yeah, there was a fascinating interview with a former Bills player. I'll give Frank a little tease in that I believe he owns a jersey of this player. It was very interesting on WEDG.
Emperor Taisho!
Yes. Well, remember, Frank, remember for Scott's birthday next time, we have to get him a, like, 12 Taisho Bills jersey, custom made.
I thought Taisho played for the Giants. This is very
confusing. That's true. Wait a second. The whole thing's falling apart.
Yeah. But we'll talk about this interview with this Bills player because I took some pretty extensive notes. But we'll chat about it next time. It's not timely. I already mentioned the Deflategate stuff, but the other stuff is interesting.
Noted.
Okay, well then that's our show.
Yep, that's it. We're done.
Mm. Well, let me finish chewing this cookie.
Well, we should probably talk about who we think is going to win the Super Bowl.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Actually, it might be relevant for some people.
Oh yeah, why do you hate the Seahawks?
Same reason I so strongly dislike the Patriots, and that is the level of arrogance that emanates from that locker room. From Pete Carroll, arrogant with the Jets when they would beat the Bills, which was rare, but he was always a jerk when they did it. With the Patriots, too, during the Just Give It to Him game in the late 90s, to him coaching USC, did a fake punt against the Bills when they were beating when the Seahawks were beating them by like 30 points a couple of years ago, down to Richard Sherman and his whole look, because I went to Stanford, I'm a smart guy, I can act like a total ass thing, to, you know, Marshawn Lynch and his inability to be in any way socially amenable. I like Russell Wilson, so I've got that going for me. The rest of that team, just I get that they're like the NFC Patriots to me.
Okay, go ahead and give us your Super Bowl non-deflategate prediction.
I'm going to say the Seahawks are just a stronger team. I don't want to analyze the game too much. They are certainly hot. I think they got their bad game out of the way in the NFC title game when that phenomenal comeback, which we didn't even talk about because we didn't broadcast since. But, I'm going to say the Seahawks, I'll say 27-20.
Yeah, if I recall on this game, at least when it first came out, the line on it was Pick'em, which I thought was kind of remarkable, just, again, given all of the potential odds that it could have been. I mean, I think it is a fair line because it is very, very difficult to, really pick between these two. I mean, obviously, at the most important positions of coach and quarterback, you kind of have to give the edge to the Patriots to a certain extent because as good as Wilson has been in general in his career, he has obviously played a mostly terrible game 2 weeks ago, and Brady obviously has had a tremendous amount of experience and is still a very good quarterback. And Belichick, Carroll has done some nice things as well, but Belichick is clearly, again, one of he's going to be one of the best coaches ever by the time he's done, if he's not already. I think I I'm definitely rooting for the Seahawks, so that's probably why I'm picking them. But I do think that the talent difference in the teams is sufficient enough that the Patriots kind of trading space for time in terms of as long as we got Brady and Belichick, we still have a shot. You definitely do have a shot as long as you have those two. It's just you can't always win. It's not always going to be enough. I think the Seahawks have enough athletes to take Gronkowski out of the picture. I think they're going to come up and hit Amendola and Edelman. I think they're not worried about the run game of the Patriots in terms of stopping it with their front seven. I think they're going to be able to get to Tom Brady with Michael Bennett, with Cliff Avril, and I don't think the Patriots' offense is going to be able to put up, more than 24 at the most, like 21 points probably. Mm-hmm. And I think the Patriots' defense, while better, is just not. I mean, as much as I like Marshawn in general, and I kind of find it a little bit amusing, but at the same time, like, really, it's the fans. The media is asking the questions the fans want to hear, or at least what they think they want to hear. And it's kind of saying, like, an F you to the fans when you're like, I don't really care about doing this, because that's who's employing the media, and that's who's employing you. So I understand, like, the media is annoying, and you don't want to have to deal with them, and some of the questions are stupid, especially for media day. They're extra stupid. But at the same time, like, are you taking yourself that seriously that you really can't afford to take out time? Anyway, that's my thoughts on Marshawn. I'm going to say 20, pretty similar to Paul. Like, I'll say, like, 27-21 Seahawks.
Well, I think you guys have laid out the reasons why I'm going to pick the Seahawks. I mean, for everything you said. But you're right, I wouldn't be surprised if the Patriots won. I guess I'm hoping that either way, the Patriots end up not being the Patriots next year. That's the biggest thing I'm rooting for from the Super Bowl, that someone somewhere says, like, okay, between the scandal and the whatever, it's time to move on or time to retire or I'm done with this, which I know is sort of a pipe dream. I think that they probably feel like they can coach and play until they're 1,000 years old. But one can hope. So I'm going to. And just to speak to Marshawn, I kind of appreciate it as a sort of performance art piece. I think you're right, Scott, that there is some level on which it's sort of disrespectful to the fact that we're all sort of paying to watch him play. On the other hand, like, the way the NFL handles this type of stuff is really ridiculous. The fact that, like, he can't even, like, pull at his pants lest they get a 15-yard penalty is kind of stupid.
That is insane, yes.
You know, and his friend in the end zone got, like, penalized or something for whatever. So, like, part of me understands that, like, while it might be a disservice in that sense, I think in the short term with what he immediately has to deal with, it makes total sense that he sort of wants to shut down and shut out the NFL. I'm kind of okay with that because I feel like the NFL sort of is a poor intermediary between fan and player. And unfortunately, this year has highlighted several examples of that. So I think we'll just leave it there, and we all have different thoughts on Marshawn Lynch. And we all are picking the Seahawks, which means we'll be talking about a Patriots Super Bowl.
Yeah.
But hopefully a Super Bowl and retirement party if it comes to that. You can tweet us, BBillsMNY, on Twitter, BBillsMNY at gmail.com, Buffalo Bills maybe next year. You can put that into iTunes or Facebook, BBillsMNY, BBillsMNY.wordpress.com. If you just search for Buffalo Bills maybe next year or BBillsMNY, you're going to find us in your favorite search engine. We're going to come up. You're going to click on us. You're going to like us. You're going to save us. You're going to subscribe to our podcast, and hopefully soon to our video cast as we get this Google Hangout stuff working more and more every day. Anyway, so thank you so much for listening. We'll let you go. Enjoy the Super Bowl. Hopefully it'll be a fun game, even with all the nonsense. And we'll, you know, even if you're worked up about the Patriots and cheating and all that stuff, I get you. I feel you. But you know what? Let's just try and enjoy a football game. And then get to the off season, because come Monday, everybody is 0-0 again. So thank you very much for listening. I'm Frank.
I'm Scott.
I'm Paul.
Have a good night, everyone.